have reached the point where all of our speakers have had their first task. And now what I would like is, if the audience is willing to sit for a half an hour,
yes,
we will have the panel talk amongst itself, if I can use that mixture of singular and plural. And then we will break again for 10 minutes, and then we will have audience interaction. So we'll go for roughly half an hour with panel members asking each other questions in a sort of an undisciplined free-for-all.
Go ahead.
Oh, well, since I was asked,
can I start?
First of all, I certainly wouldn't want to stimulate neurons because the end effect of a neural circuit can often be described much more simply than describing the work of the individual neurons. So this is based on very vision algorithms mostly. In fact, things like the insect tracking is done by robots with far less computing power. For instance, the Carnegie Mellon Nav Labs, one of which drove across the country, was able to track roads, and there was a certain control algorithm which keeps it on the road, which isn't very different from the optimum thing. And it was a less than 100 MIPS machine. It was about 50 MIPS running that. And the algorithms that I expect to be controlling this general purpose robot will in fact have been developed over nearly 10 years in a large competitive industry and be quite efficient in their use of those 5,000 MIPS or whatever. So it's a matter of squeezing every last bit. This is
what happens when the robot gets off the road.
It recognizes most of the time that it's not on the road. It has a library of road cross sections. It stops.
Just like a lizard.
Well, the thing is, if you want something that progresses without stopping, that's just a small change in the programming. Indeed, there are generic algorithms that drive machines off road. You're picking particular behaviors and saying this particular machine doesn't have that particular behavior, but in fact it could have.
The lizard is a really autonomous device. The lizard is a really autonomous device. It manages to refuel itself, take itself through terrain that it hasn't even seen, manage to go on, survive day after day in very unusual circumstances. I don't know any robot at all that's even as autonomous as an ant.
And in fact, we don't have the computing power of an ant, really. But anyway, also we don't have the genetic machinery, which is sort of an independent underlay, which is used, for instance, to digest food. That's a mechanism that I don't expect to be in these cleaning robots. So basically, what I'm saying is that we can make these specific machines with these specific functions, which are evolved by an economy to do the particular things they're supposed to do. If you wanted to evolve a machine that could take care of itself most of the time out in the open, I think we could, but I don't think that'll be the incentive to do it.
Well, first of all, let me take issue with the contention that software hasn't grown exponentially. I mean, I've been in the software industry for 40... Hello? No. I've been in the software industry for 40 years, and the kinds of software systems that I see my teams deal with, and I'm not bragging about my teams because I think... The kinds of systems that teams I'm involved with are developing, and I'm not bragging about my teams. They're really just competitive. But software teams in general, the productivity per person has grown exponentially. We create with very small teams of people extremely complex systems because the infrastructure of tools has grown along with the requisite hardware. Now, it's not my contention at all, nor is it Hans, that MIPS alone automatically gives you intelligent behavior. I think you've got to look at developments in many different fields. I'm encouraged by the fact that those brain regions which we have maps of and have at least some idea of their structure, that we can understand the algorithms, which are very different than the algorithms we see in conventional computers. They're digital controlled analog, they're massively parallel, they're based on self-organizing paradigms, but we can understand basically what's going on and recreate them, and there are many examples. I think I mentioned earlier Carver Mead's vision chips, which perform very comparably to a biological retina. The systems that Dr. Holland described in terms of neural nets are really not state-of-the-art systems with no feedback loops that are organized in simple layers that only have a fan out of a factor of 10. We're already substantially beyond that. I mean, this is the field that I've worked in for 35 years. Fan outs are at the next level of magnitude, more like 100 or even higher in some cases. Systems that look, that have the kind of very organic feedback loops and interesting, intricate architectures that we see in biological systems. And indeed, we get much more intelligent behavior, and these are more challenging systems, but that is the state of the art. The future is not simply a function of MIPS. It's an interaction of more powerful computers, more powerful brain models, more powerful self-organizing systems, more powerful genetic algorithms. If you have a genetic algorithm that has a fixed chromosome, you're only going to get certain type of behavior. But what we see in biological evolution is that the meta-evolution also evolves, and that you, biological systems will develop new chromosomes, and they'll change the functions of the genes, and so on. So you need more powerful genetic algorithms that can actually evolve the methods of evolution. And copying or reverse engineering the brain is only one paradigm. I think we'll see an interaction, as we already have today, between biologically inspired models, understanding how the brain works in certain instances, and that will grow enormously more powerful as we can scan the brain with higher resolution. Just more powerful experiments that we do on our own in terms of artificial intelligence. I'll leave it at that.
I'd just like to ask a question of the audience, which is how many people think that in nanotechnology the advantage is to the offense? And the advantage is to the defense?
And how many people think it requires further investigation? I think this is an important issue. The only thing that I've been able to think of, I think that it's likely it lies with defense if the defense has a greater resources of mass, energy, and can preposition forces. But that's a speculation at this point. I think when I get into the detailed measure, countermeasure, counter-countermeasure, I cannot evaluate the outcome. And I think to evaluate that outcome not only requires a base of research which provides the specific capabilities of the systems, but also a very deliberate analysis. Now, there's an interesting question as to how much of this analysis we wish to take place in public and how much of this analysis we wish to take place a little bit more discreetly. If there is careful analysis of the measure-countermeasure sort of situations, do we want to move to a system where we have public awareness that such an analysis is taking place, some public awareness of some of the major outlines of the analysis, but yet at the same time remain confidential about some of the details, some of the specific technical issues involved, on the grounds that publication of those issues would not contribute to the public debate, but might offer an advantage to someone who wished to use those systems.
Can I ask just you a question? Do you think in bioweapons the advantage is to the offense or the defense?
I'm not sure. I would say that in biology it looks as though for some, you know, the plant kingdom has been at World War III with the animal kingdom for some hundreds of millions of years, and it looks as though the advantage right now is held by the animal kingdom, if you look at who's eating who.
Well, I'm afraid that would not agree with the scientific consensus. The audience, excuse me, the audience will have its say afterwards.
Well, I just want to comment on what Bill Joyce said earlier, that it's quite clear that the shields are more dangerous than what we're shielding from. I don't think that's clear at all. We have one example of a self-replicating non-biological entity, which exists today. It's a completely new type of entity. It didn't exist a century ago, which is computer viruses. And they are out of control once they're unleashed by some malevolent soul. They can't be retrieved. Now, it's true that computer viruses don't threaten us in the same way that a self-replicating nano-engineered entity would. But if we use this as an example, it's nonetheless potentially destructive. I mean, you could describe where a computer virus out of control could completely snarl our communication networks and render our computers useless and overwhelm them. We do have primitive immune systems. They're pretty effective. The damage from computer viruses is considerable. It's been I saw an estimate recently of billions of dollars, but that's less than 1% of the benefit of information technology. It's, in fact, a pretty trivial damage compared to the benefit of the computational technology that we have. Is at least one encouraging example that even simple immune systems can deal with these issues. The recent break-in at these e-portals, the immune system was basically just the general reaction of the government and of companies, which was very, if anything, an overreaction, but nonetheless very quickly dealt with the problem. Y2K, a lot of people felt we overreacted to that problem, but nonetheless there was tremendous effort. There were some real Y2K issues, and it's impressive that this motley collection of state governments and corporations and third world countries and government agencies actually were able to deal with the problem as effectively as they did. So we do have an immune system in terms of our human communication, which is increased by things like the Internet. Our ability to deal with the first example of a non-biological reproducing entity, the computer virus, I think is encouraging.
I have a scenario that I'd like to ask both Hans and Ray about to see whether they agree with it. Everyone is here probably familiar with the Tinker Toy computer that Danny Hillis made. It was a computer made from Tinker Toys. What was interesting about that was that essentially this was a computer that somebody could have made hundreds of years ago if they had thought of it. And so my question is, here's the scenario. The year is 2100, and there's... So 100 years from now, and there's two guys and their friends, and they discover in some basement somewhere, packed away, two Pentium, 500 megahertz machines, or a bunch of them, in storage somewhere, brand new. And they decide to see if they could make the AIs that exist at that time using these very primitive machines. And they actually succeed. Do you think that's plausible? But that basically, if somebody came back from the future and knew how to do it, that they could take the existing hardware right now and do it now?
Well, I don't know if the existing hardware is quite enough or not, but there's undoubtedly a search space, and within that search space there are intelligent things that you would classify as intelligent, and there may well be somewhere in that space one that doesn't require that much computing. But I think the amount of memory that's needed to represent, if you want to talk about human level intelligence, is probably too small in existing machines. We probably need terabytes rather than gigabytes. But
yeah, I don't think you can come remotely close with contemporary machines to emulating anything like human or even other animal intelligence. I do agree with Hans that you can reduce the computational requirements if you model things at a different level. Rather than trying to model every interneuronal connection, neurotransmitter concentration, you actually model things at a more systemic level, systems of neurons, and try to emulate them. You could do that with less computation. But if you look at what the human brain is capable, even based on what we understand today, just human vision vastly outstrips contemporary hardware. The sort of massive computation that we anticipate is a necessary, but I agree, not sufficient condition for emulating that level of intelligence.
Ray reminded me of sensory, which I think we couldn't emulate, but still be able to do a Turing test passer.
Well, I don't think so. I think you can pass the Turing test without being able to master sensory level intelligence. And I think our ability to, for example, be emotional, get the joke, be funny, understand the plot of a movie, or even understand a book, which doesn't require the sensory input because it's a relatively trivial amount of data to just accept the text of a book, does require the subtlety of human intelligence. And again, the scale of our massive parallelism, 100 trillion fold parallelism, is one of the necessary ingredients to achieve that kind of subtlety.
Although I think it's basically a question of data compression. You might have been surprised that the subtlety of some intricate painting could be compressed by a factor of 1,000 before modern data compression methods were found, and it might be that there's such a compression method that squeezes just enough that it can fool people. So there's a anyway.
I'd just like to actually direct a question to Bill. When I said the point about my feeling was that software functionality had not followed the Moore curve, Ray subtly shifted it into productivity for producing software. I think the question is, does the operating system, for instance, that we have now look like a Moore's curve different from the operating system that we had 30 years ago? I'd like to hear, since Bill works directly in that kind of thing, or did, I'd like to hear his point.
Its size seems to be Moore's law, but its function seems to be... Its size is growing as Moore's law, and its function is fixed.
Well, Bill, while you're on the hot seat, I'd like to ask you another question. When I read your Wired article and listened to your talk here today, I was sort of taken by the relinquishment option as being the most attractive. But I'd like you to focus on questions of what examples do we have where there have been commercial interests opposed to a scientific result that have ever... operated in that way, and I'd like to suggest four sub-questions. Smoking, which has certainly been certified as harmful to health for decades, but commercial interests had other ideas. Global warming, where we see petroleum companies and automobile companies running TV commercials against the Kyoto Treaty. And the genome, where the obvious problems of insurance and confidentiality and privacy and discrimination are manifest, but commercial interests would have a different view. How could this possibly be different?
Well, I think the issue is that because it's going to be so difficult to get the commercial interests not to do extremely dangerous things, that's why we have a 30 to 50% realistic extinction risk.
Well, if I could take a comment on that. The claim that the commercial world has a strong desire to wipe out its customer base is, I think, incorrect. If anything, the commercial world has a strong desire to maintain its customer base in a healthy and paying status. And in addition, I think when you start looking at this, when you start looking in detail at the ways in which you can use a self-replicating manufacturing base, an artificial self-replicating manufacturing base, you find very rapidly that what you don't want to do is produce the all-singing, all-dancing, capable system that can do anything, anywhere. You find instead that you want to divide function, and that in particular, the kind of systems you would want would be systems that would function in a very artificial setting to produce more product, but that any system that you produced and sold and made available in the world would not have any self-replicative capability. That indeed, from a commercial point of view, you would wish to sell products which people would use and throw out and then buy another one. And I think that the basic premise that we would want to design and build a very complex system which would self-replicate wherever it needed to be, while it does have a certain attractiveness from the point of view of immediate conceptual simplicity, when you start looking at it in detail, you find that this concept begins to break down.
I'd like to ask John Holland and John Koza, both of whom are concerned with genetic algorithms and genetic programming, in other words, a kind of evolution within a computer, whether they see the life in essentially the way that it has been characterized, that is, that when we have self-reproducing entities of any sort, that they will pose problems to our society, to the world, that are that stem directly from the way life evolved. That is, the intense competition, the fierce competition, the natural selection. Does self-reproduction necessarily carry with it this lethal threat of going out of control and exploding in the way that, in a certain sense, life, carbon-based life, has done? Does my question make sense? I don't know. In other words, does self-reproduction of any sort pose lethal dangers, no matter how tiny it is? I mean, viruses are an example.
The question's awfully complex. Lethal dangers. The first thing that's going to happen when I have a self-replicating system almost certainly is going to be variation on the self-replication. That means that I'm going to get diversity. I'm going to have different parts of the environment exploited by different kinds of organisms. That's all familiar. I think, let me go to one of the extreme cases, gray goo. A self-replicating molecule that or nano machine that I can somehow put out there, and all it will be to replicate, not produce anything useful, and cover our Earth with several meters of gray goo.
A couple of comments. John Holland keeps mentioning things we haven't seen to date. That's not a strong argument of what we won't see in the future, but just to change the argument slightly.
It's not a strong argument that we will see them.
Well, I think you have to fully follow the arguments. How many people in the audience noticed this news item? Sun Microsystems announced today that it was relinquishing all research and development that might improve the intelligence of its software, the computational power of its computers, or the effectiveness of its interprocessor communication systems, due to concerns that the inevitable result of progress in these fields may lead to profound and irreversible dangers to the environment and even to the human race itself. Better to be safe than sorry, Sun's chief scientist Bill Joy was quoted as saying. I think the point. Well, it's a cheap shot, I know, but. But there's a serious point to it, which is the progress of the type that we're talking about is the result of many innovative companies, thousands of companies, tens of thousands, millions of individuals who are contributing each in their own way. I don't think nanotechnology is any more dangerous than the inevitable result of more powerful communications and more powerful computers. I mean, you can describe self-replicating entities that are not nanotechnology that are much more dangerous because they're a little bit more intelligent if they're built at a slightly larger scale. So that's why this is a difficult issue. That's why I think technology progress, quote unquote, is inevitable. We have to deal with this in a sophisticated way. The kinds of suggestions that Ralph Merkel made, which the Foresight Institute has worked on for 14 years. If we look at biotech, which I don't think is 20 years away, I think the dangers are here today. I think means exist right now to create bioengineered pathogens. But how many people in the audience would want to stop bioengineering? I mean, anybody who has a friend who has cancer, heart disease, any of these diseases, there's a tremendous, very promising progress that's going to be made through bioengineering. But wiping out all technology, I don't think is feasible. And these kinds of dangers are something we have to contend with in a sophisticated way by through a whole series of regulation, ethical considerations, design considerations. And unfortunately, we are going to have to create immune systems and shields. The genie's out of the bottle with biotechnology. I mean, the knowledge is already out there. We'd better hope that we create a bioengineered antiviral drug to combat with the combat.